Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan, South Sudan, and the rest of Africa this Monday, November 25th, 2024. The dollar exchange rate in South Sudan continues to climb up, and African leaders returning from COP29 meeting in Baku, Azerbaijan, are disappointed. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Calm has returned to South Sudan's capital, Juba, after a shootout last week between soldiers guarding the house of the former chief spy, General Akol Kur Kuoch. But that's not the case with traders across the town. For VOA News, Denis Logonyi reports from Juba.
A forex dealer who only identifies himself only as John for safety reasons says since last week's shooting, the exchange rate of the South Sudan pound to the dollar has risen because of a shortage of US dollars in the market. He says traders are afraid to release more money because some believe Juba might witness more violence in the near future.
Today there is a little bit of an increase due to the incident that happened 2 days back. It led to an increase of the dollar rate in the forex. Because businessmen are scared of running their business because they fear to offend their shops and people are just constant at home. Money also has become scarce, so currently the life is a little bit hard.
Kajumba Derek deals in imports and sales of motorcycle parts in Juba. He says the dollar's scarcity has prevented him from buying more spare parts.
This money, since the previous days, yesterday and today, there is no money in the market and very expensive. The money increased from 470,000 to 520,000 SSP per $100 in the market. It affects us so much because money is not there. I wanted to go and buy a few things in the market, but there is no way. The most important thing now is peace. When there is peace, all things will be well.
Some plainclothes officers from the Criminal Investigative Department have been deployed in markets across Juba to watch over traders.
Since this incident happened, these CIDs, they do fluke to grab some money from the businessmen. You find that they will arrest you, that where are you taking this money? So businessmen are becoming scared to run their business in the city. You know, once if there is a breakdown, gunshot like that, it give them that courage. They said it is now their time to loot money from the businessmen. And in fact, this thing right now is ongoing.
Warren George runs a mobile money business in Monuki. He says Thursday shootout affected his business.
Some of my customers, few of them even ran that being given the services. Some ran with my money. They had to also come and follow them afterwards. I daily close at around 9, 10. And that day by 7, I was at home. So it affected. That day I didn't gain as usual my business.
Akol Madwok, the head of economics department at the University of Juba, says conflicts have far-reaching impacts on economies across the globe.
We believe that whenever there is a war in any country, you find that businesses will close down or, they will be worried because you find that most of the foreigners will be seeking dollars in order for them to run outside the country. And the same to many South Sudanese will also be worried to run out the country. My advice to the government is that they should try by all means to resolve conflict instead of creating conflict.
Several businesses were looted in Juba 2013 and 2016 when conflict erupted between the two rival forces of President Salva Kiir and his deputy Riek Machar. Since then, the dollar exchange rate continued to gain strength against the South Sudan pound in the backdrop of hyperinflation in the country. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
From Juba, we move to Torit, where Eastern Equatorial State Ministry of Health says maternal mortality rate is still a major issue affecting many families across the state. State health officials are asking the National Health Ministry to focus on improving primary health care in the state. Kaltuma Vanessa has more from Torit.
Christina Achi, who lives in the Haikuku residential area of Tarit Town, along with her daughter Akongo Josephine, takes care of a month-old baby whose mother died during delivery. The baby was left to her by her deceased cousin Ikwai Joseph, who died while delivering her twins. Christina says her cousin was anemic and refused to deliver at the hospital.
She was brought 3 days ago. When she was checked, the doctor says she has low blood level and advised on treatment. After she came home, she refused to return to the hospital. When she was in labor, she refused to go to the hospital because she was scared that she would be operated. She stayed until she delivered one baby at home. Because she was having twins, we carried her forcefully to the hospital to deliver the other baby. But on the arrival at the hospital, she died. Akong remained with the live baby. Now she is the one who takes care of the baby. But we can't afford milk for the baby.
Mary Claudio is a health worker who visits homes to vaccinate children. She says she met Josephine and the baby in a worrying situation, saying the condition of the baby is not good.
She told
me, "This is not my baby. Her mother died while giving birth. Now the baby has no milk. That's why he's crying. The father is in the village and has no work. I am the aunt, but I have no job too." When the father of the baby arrived, he told them, "I have nothing. I just came to check on you." Then I asked the father, "Don't you have anything like goat in the village to sell?" He said, "No, it is the wife that was taking care of them." Then he ordered the aunt to mix water and salt to give the baby. Sure, they mixed the water and salt and gave the baby in front of me.
Mary Manya, deputy matron of Tarit State Hospital, says the maternal mortality rate in the state hospital has been dropped from 13 to 4 women dying every year.
2008, 2009, that time it will reach up to 13, because that time these cadres are not complete in the facility. Doctors are also few, maybe only 2 to 3 doctors, and specialists are not there, and the midwife, trained midwives are not there. The TBS are the one managing the mother. That's why the rate was high, and at that time also blood bank was not there, unless from this replacement, and the replacement community also so rigid to donate a blood. There's so many contributing factors at that time. Coming toward these years, at least it was reducing. When the Ministry of Health started to bring the consultants and gynecologists,
Christina Oboya, Eastern Equatoria State Director for Reproductive Health, calls on state and national government officials to improve and construct more health facilities in remote parts of the state.
Most of our health facilities are very far from some other communities and the villages. So you find that it's very difficult for the mothers to go for the reproductive services. Even for delivery, they cannot go there. They cannot access. So if the government was able, would build more facilities for this mother, then she'd also employ more staff. But most of the people who are working are the people getting incentive. And then also the knowledge. They don't know that it is very important for them. When they are pregnant, they must attend antenatal care.
South Sudan is estimated to have the world's highest maternal mortality, with 1,223 women dying per 100,000 live births across the country. For VOA News, I am Kaltuma Vanessa, reporting from Eastern Equatorial State Capital, Tarit.
From Tarit, we move to Port Sudan, where the Norwegian Refugee Council Secretary General Jan Egeland, who spent this past week in Sudan, tells VOA's Carol Van Damme that he saw the ravages of war with his own eyes in Darfur. The Norwegian Refugee Council says a year and a half of war has spawned relentless countdown to a near collapse in Sudan, as more than 20 million suffer from violence, hunger, and forced displacement.
spent the last 2 days in Darfur, in West Darfur, in El Geneina, which was one of the places where this massive ethnic cleansing took place, and hundreds of thousands of people fled from there here into Chad.
Describe what you saw and what people told you there in Darfur and now El Geneina.
Well, in El Geneina, you see every sign of this horrific war, the horrific violence, and the horrific removal of an entire ethnic group, the Masalit. Our own office, Norwegian Refugee Council's office, was burnt, destroyed, looted. We were in an area where there were a lot of attacks and where the civilian population was also driven away and towards Chad. So I saw home after home destroyed. But I also saw people tentatively returning to try to rebuild. And the Norwegian Refugee Council has a large aid program in Darfur now. With support from USAID, we are providing subsidized, free, at very low price bread every morning to hundreds of thousands of people through nearly 500 bakeries.
A little bit of good news goes a long way for a place like Sudan.
But of course, I mean, the strongest impression I have after having spent now a week in and around Sudan, I was also on the East Coast in Port Sudan, is that this is indeed the biggest drama on our watch. It's the biggest humanitarian crisis, the biggest displacement crisis. 14 million people have been driven out of their homes. It's the biggest hunger crisis. Some 20 million people need food aid. I remember 20 years back when I was the UN humanitarian chief, we got President Bush, we got Prime Minister Blair in the United Kingdom, we got the European Union to have it on the highest levels of government to do whatever they could to help Darfur. Today, the crisis is three times that, and we're not even close to having the attention and the aid and the peace efforts that are needed.
When it comes to the peace efforts that are needed, I just talked to a person that is have met with the Sudanese officials there this past week. Even though they're not at the negotiating table, he's believing that the Sudanese army officials will be willing to come to the table and talk ceasefire. Do you feel like that's even a prospect on the horizon?
It's not very likely, no. All indications are that all sides in this war, there are many armed actors, that all sides still believe they have more to achieve through violence, an armed struggle. But I'm glad that the United States, the United Kingdom, Norway, some Gulf countries are trying to get peace talks again. We hope they will succeed. And in the meantime, let's at least have maximum pressure to stop the arms flow, to stop the support for armed actors, to stop the fuel to the fire, which is brought from international actors.
That's Norwegian Refugee Council Secretary General Jan Egeland. He spoke to VOA's Carol Van Damme last week after returning from Darfur. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. African countries are disappointed by the outcome of COP29 climate change conference that concluded in Baku. Find out more after the break. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. African countries are disappointed by the outcome of the COP29 climate change conference that concluded in Baku, Azerbaijan, on Sunday. In a new agreement, developed nations must contribute $300 billion a year to poor regions to help them cope with climate change and help them invest in cleaner energy. But Africans and others are suffering the worst effects of a rise in global temperatures say the amount is inadequate. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
A group of developing countries known as the G77 plus China had pushed for richer nations to give $1.3 trillion a year in climate financing at the United Nations Climate Summit. Some economists calculate that's what's needed to address global warming, which has been caused by centuries of mostly developed countries' use of fossil fuels, including coal and oil. They emit carbon gases when burned, and these gases cause heat to be trapped in the Earth's atmosphere, sparking global warming and extreme weather events such as drought and flooding. At the final session in Baku, the leader of India's COP29 delegation, Chandni Raina, expressed outrage at the $300 billion deal she said had been forced upon poor nations.
The amount that is proposed to be mobilized is abysmally poor. It's a paltry sum. It is not something that will enable conducive climate action that is necessary for the survival of our country and for the growth of our people, their livelihoods. And I'm sorry to say that we cannot accept it.
The agreement says more than 20 highly industrialized countries must contribute $300 billion annually by 2035. That's triple the earlier pledge of $100 billion a year by 2020, which was only met in 2022. Speaking to reporters in Baku, the director of environmental group Power Shift Africa, Mohamed Addo, criticized the agreement for not committing countries to move away from fossil fuels.
To be able to tackle climate change effectively is massive reductions in emissions, and to also afford the vulnerable countries the opportunity to adapt to the inevitable impact of climate change and deal with loss and damage. Developing countries, out of an assessment that was done by the UN, have said they require at least $1.3 trillion per year to be able to contribute to the global effort to tackle climate change. What the rich world are now offering is just 20% of that, which effectively is a reduction of the promise they made 15 years ago. Now, if we're truly serious about emissions reductions, and if we're serious about providing solidarity to the vulnerable countries to be able to adapt, we should provide them the support that they require.
Addo says the agreement in Baku continues the developed world's exploitation of Africa.
60% of the renewable energy resources, especially solar, is in Africa. 40% of the critical minerals that are needed to help the world decarbonize are in Africa. But you know what? Africa attracts 2% of the total global renewable energy investment. So the continent, with 600 million people without electricity, a billion people without clean cooking, instead of the rich world providing them the support so that we can be able to develop in a climate-compatible manner, they are hoarding that and not sharing the resources, both by way of finance but also technology.
In Africa, which has seen crippling drought in the southern part of the continent and devastating floods further north this year, many point out that climate aid money thus far has come mostly in the form of loans, adding to national debt loads. They are concerned the same will happen this time around. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
As the world marks the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, activists are worried over the rise in femicide across Africa. Here is more from our reporter in Abuja, Nigeria.
Femicide is the gender-based killing of women. According to the United Nations, Africa has the highest femicide rate in the world. Most of them occur in South Africa, Nigeria, and Kenya. In 2022, the UN reported that more than 20,000 women and girls were killed by intimate partners, family members, and strangers, though certain numbers of femicide in Africa remain unaccounted for. Blessing Chinedu is a survivor whose partner and the father of her children poured acid on her face. She describes her experience.
This is now 5 months now.
This is 5 months now. June 6, 2024, this year. That's when it happened. As of today, I don't know what I did to make him pour acid on my face. Because that very day before this happened, we didn't fight. We didn't quarrel. I saw him pouring something on my clothes. Blessing Chinedu, like every surviving victim of femicide in Africa, is seeking for justice. However, there are reports of cases where authorities fail to respond to victims' plea or families' plea for help. A woman and children's rights activist, Wanda Ebe, told VOA that most femicide cases in Africa are swept under the carpet by authorities.
When men kill women in Africa or in Nigeria as a case study, and the case is reported at the station, the police will even aid the perpetrators to report the matter as unknown cause of death. These cases are being downplayed, and they are also being underreported. And that's why it keeps going on and on and on, and it's even getting worse these days.
Underreporting and varying definitions of what can be classified as femicide make it difficult to get accurate figures on the killing of women in Africa. Ebe calls on officials to stop ignoring femicide and blaming the victims.
If African leaders and security personnel who handle femicide cases in a firm way, with open sanctions for people to truly see that the perpetrators are punished, femicide will stop.
She says everyone must create a culture where women are secure and valued by speaking out, promoting awareness, and encouraging change. The International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women acts as a catalyst for change and empowers individuals and communities to stand against all forms of violence. This is VOA News in Abuja, Nigeria.
Countries around the world are bracing for economic upheaval as incoming U.S. President Donald Trump threatens massive tariffs, especially on China. The uncertainty has left governments and businesses struggling with how to respond, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
During his first term, Donald Trump imposed sweeping tariffs on China, shaking the global economy. Ahead of his return, Trump is vowing even more drastic measures, 10% tariffs on all imports to the U.S. and a staggering 60% on goods from China. While China hasn't commented directly on Trump's threats, it has warned against further trade tensions. Mao Ning is the Chinese Foreign Affairs Ministry spokesperson. She says, we don't answer hypothetical questions, but reiterates there's no winner in a trade war, nor will the world benefit from it. Any Trump tariffs could especially hurt economies that depend on exports. But an expanded U.S.-China trade war could also create opportunities. Many countries have benefited as production shifts away from China to avoid tariffs. Thailand's commerce minister recently told VOA's Thai service his country has seen an influx of U.S. companies relocating factories from China. He says we should be able to weather this. He actually sees these problems as benefits for Thailand. He believes we can be an investment destination for every country. That approach comes with risks, though. Many countries that gained from trade moving out of China now heavily rely on exporting to the United States, leaving them even more vulnerable to any blanket Trump tariffs or efforts to crack down on rerouted goods. The concerns stretch beyond the biggest U.S. trading partners. In Africa, where trade with the U.S. is already limited, higher tariffs could make access even harder, one analyst told VOA's Africa 54.
If we talk about manufacturing, if we're talking about production of produce, pineapples, and coming to the U.S. market, it's going to be difficult. I'm not optimistic about U.S. trade with Africa if we're talking about increasing tariffs.
Much of the uncertainty stems from Trump's unpredictability. During his first term, he often used the prospect of tariffs as a bargaining tool before eventually striking individual trade deals, says analyst Jayant Menon.
Trump is not a protectionist, I think, right? He's a deal maker. That's what he likes to present himself as, you know, the art of the deal and all that. So he likes free trade agreements that he has a role in.
Menon says countries targeted by Trump could push for new trade agreements instead of tit-for-tat tariff escalations that could harm themselves and the global economy. Not all of Trump's proposals point toward increased protectionism. He's also suggested rolling back subsidies for U.S.-made electric vehicles, subsidies put in place by the Biden administration. Again, Menon.
He's already called them, you know, silly in a podcast with Joe Rogan. So he's probably going to roll them back. And that's a positive, right, in terms of the distortions that affect the global economy.
Both risks and opportunities as the world figures out how to respond to the return of an unpredictable U.S. president. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
That's all from us this Monday, November 25th, 2024. We now leave you with Victoria Ole and Kasang Dedi with their song Salam Ya Sudan. For more on our programs, visit www.voaafrica.com. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbel Yabaru, and engineer, Dan Brody, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the fourth Thursday in November, Americans observe Thanksgiving. Although the holiday resembles traditional harvest celebrations common to agricultural societies dating back thousands of years, Thanksgiving honors the experience of the first Europeans to settle in what is today the northeastern United States. Sometime between September 21st and November 11th, 1621, 53 English men, women, and children were joined by some 90 Native Americans in a feast to give thanks for their first harvest in their new home, the Plymouth Colony in today's state of Massachusetts. Having arrived in November of the previous year, they were woefully unprepared for the rigors of a Massachusetts winter. Had it not been for vigorous help from their Wampanoag neighbors, it is likely that none of the 102 Europeans who first stepped off the ship Mayflower and onto American soil would have lived to see the following spring. That first Thanksgiving celebration, although it was not yet called that, featured games, military demonstrations, and much rejoicing. And following a religious service, a feast of venison, duck, and other fowl, fish, and shellfish, along with dried corn and cornbread, vegetables, and fruit, was enjoyed by all. The tradition remains to this day. Although the menu has changed, friends and family from near and far now gather around the holiday table where a roast turkey takes pride of place, surrounded by stuffing and cranberry sauce, potatoes and gravy, and vegetables of every sort, with a pumpkin pie waiting in the wings. It is still a day for playing games during the day and for watching a football game on television while digesting dinner. Throughout our country's history, the season of reflection and giving thanks comes in good times and tough ones, said President Joe Biden. Before there was a United States of America, the Pilgrims celebrated Thanksgiving in honor of their first successful harvest and the support and generosity of the Wampanoag people who made it possible, said President Biden. Thanksgiving began as a prayer of gratitude by immigrants who, if not for the support of their native neighbors, would likely not have survived their first year in North America. Today, Thanksgiving is a gathering of family and friends, once again offering their gratitude for a chance at a bright future.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.